this is the second bunch of episodes that I'm releasing in one day. I think there's going to be 8 of them again. Now, with that last batch, I had to take a quick break because I was on tour. I didn't have the time to watch all those movies that I needed to make a proper episode. And as the regular listeners will already know, those episodes tend to be split into 2 parts and they roll on for around 5 hours. So many hours upon hours upon hours of watching and writing and compiling and recording. And I just don't think I'm going to have the time to do it justice. So if you woke up this morning and you're expecting to hear the first part of the 1920s to 1930s episode, many apologies. That will be coming out on the 1st of November. And I very much doubt that this will be happening again, not until mid-2022 anyway. That is the next time I'm planning on having a holiday. I just really don't want to bring you lot a half-assed stab at an episode. I'm just not willing to do it. So instead, as in August, I've taken a bunch of my favourite chats that I've already included in those long-winded episodes and I've pulled them out for anyone to listen to individually. There will no doubt still be some content in the month, but the regular programming will continue on November the 1st. And with that, here you go.
Excellent.
In 1964, Vincent Price starred in The Last Man on Earth. In 2007, Will Smith took the lead in I Am Legend. But in 1971, a 48-year-old Charlton Heston, he was cast as Robert Neville in The Omega Man.
The last man on Earth lives in a fortress.
Discovered Jack. How does that grab you, Caesar?
The last man on Earth always carries an automatic weapon. The last man on Earth is hunting. Because the last man on Earth is not alone. Charlton Heston, Rosalind Cash. Omega Man, rated GP.
The last man alive is not alone.
Due to an experimental vaccine, Dr. Robert Neville is the only human survivor of an apocalyptic war waged with biological weapons. Beside him, only a few hundred deformed, nocturnal people remain, sensitive to light and homicidally psychotic. Now, this is going to be a good one. So, in 1954, Richard Matheson, he wrote a sci-fi horror book and he called it I Am Legend. And this, of course, is pretty well known for shaping a lot of the zombie and vampiric movie and literature tropes for many, many years to come. But for me, its biggest influence lay at the hand of its treatment of the post-apocalypse. And who doesn't love post-apocalyptic films? Whether you're into drama, horror, comedy, there is so much awesome stuff to mine. And unlike zombies, I think it's still ripe for the picking. I think if you did ask me, I could sit down and I could probably jot down well over 100 movies that I've seen since this one was written that have truly taken inspiration from this prose. Now, he also wrote a bunch of Twilight Zone episodes. And so many horror movies, it'd take me 10 minutes just to list them all here. But let's just say they range from The Legend of Hell House to Jaws 3D. Just everything in between. And you get the gist. But onto this movie itself. And I didn't struggle with it, but I know some people might. The thing is, I'm no fan of Charlton Heston. His stance on firearms in particular is particularly putrid. Yet in a couple of documentaries and extra features that I've seen on other films, I can see that he's a fierce campaigner for equal rights, and he's full on against discrimination of any kind. And that was in the early 60s, when he had a ridiculous amount of influence amongst the youth. And I get it. People are complex. Individuals do not always fit into the boxes that I'd like them to, even if I love their art. And speaking of the art, and that's the most important thing here, as an actor, he still leaves a fair bit to be desired as well. His character choices tend to be all so boisterous and manly, and whenever the role calls for some nuanced depth, it always seems out of his reach. I'm never convinced. But I've not seen everything that he's done, of course not, and I've yet to see him in Soylent Green, and I know people rave about that one, so I cannot wait to get that down my gullet. So there is a chance that I still may be proven wrong about this, but Planet of the Apes, Touch of Evil, Airport, Earthquake, even Ben-Hur, to me this is just a man doing a job, like Steven Seagal is maybe doing his job. And it's great for what it is, of course it is, if that's all you want. If it's just brute action, fine. But he's not got the charm or wit of a Bruce Willis, or the self-awareness of a Stallone. As an action hero, he just leaves me cold. Always this has been the way, ever since I saw him when I was young. And yet somehow, this film is still really good. And I mean, it's really, really good. It ticks way more boxes than it leaves blank. But I know all my negative feelings towards him are just going to infect this little section, so I don't want to just leave it to me. So I wanted to speak to someone else about it. Now, after a great time that I had experiencing The Pale Door, a film that I watched last year, one thing really popped for me, and it was the score. It totally grabbed me. It really worked within the context of the film, and I loved listening to it separately. So I looked up who the composer was, and I found out it was a fella that lives in Texas called Alex Cuervo. And of course, what do you do then? You get in touch with him to partake in a year in horror, and so here we are. I'm really happy that he chose the Omega Man. He got stuck in with me, and I really appreciate it. So this is a really good one. I'll see you on the other side. Here is us chatting all things Omega Man. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me.
Man, I'm dead excited. I came across you because of your score for The Pale Door. And today we're going to have a quick chat about The Omega Man, or The Omega Man. I'd like to say Omega Man.
Omega, yeah.
Okay. Now, my real interest in having someone that is a composer watching this film is straight away I'm thinking, what do you think of the score to this one?
Well, it's very much of its time, you know. I mean, it sounds like a film score of a movie of this budget from the early 70s. And it's the music is great. I mean, the soaring on its, I would say in the context of the film, it's very old fashioned, and I don't think it works to our modern sensibilities about how film scores function now. But in isolation, the music is great. I mean, the theme specifically is just the soaring kind of string and woodwind thing. It's just very cinematic, early 70s cinema. And then as it moves further in, we get into the kind of jazz pastiche kind of stuff that was in vogue then, with, you know, a little bit of the funky bongo percussion things going on. And I really like that stuff a lot because it's fun. It's very, it's pastiche, again, by modern standards, but it's fun and it's cool music. So the score, I mean, Ron Grainer, I wasn't super familiar. I did, you know, some research on him, conducted and wrote all the orchestration, like was really a one-man show as far, I mean, there's all the musicians that perform the score, but he wrote it and orchestrated it. And, you know, typically that was done or is done by a team of people. So this was a big undertaking, which I guess more people were multidisciplinarians back then. I guess you had to be. But anyway, so the score is interesting and good on its own. In the later parts of the film, it really falls apart for me because it's so at odds with what's happening. You know, where from a more contemporary point of view, when the intensity and things are ratcheting up, I really want the score to engage more and be more. And it was really kind of just passive or even jaunty when it should have been kind of intense. And like, even, I mean, there's films from this time period that the score would ratchet up and get intense. So it was a weird artistic choice. And I must have been the director. Especially during the climax of the film, the score really took a weird turn for me.
You're so correct. Like, in my notes on this one, especially towards the end, like you say, I'm like, what's going on here? It's like, I know that post-apocalyptic type film hasn't been mastered yet, but as you say, there are plenty of odd and peculiar and minor key scores going on at that time, and yet it does feel like they've put it a different film score in at points.
There's a few ways to think about it. I think I was trying to imagine what the director was going for then. And early on, I can get it because Charlton Heston is very wisecracking and he's meant to be a very, you know, a guy that's making the best of a horrible situation. And it shows his resilience, you know, as a character. Like, it shows kind of his sense of humor. And I feel like it really kind of connects to his kind of like, you know, grumbly kind of settling into this fucked up world, right? But then later, I think because it is a tragedy, ultimately, the film. So I do feel like they were trying to kind of lead you so that the tragic stuff didn't just land right up suddenly, which would have worked for me personally. But maybe they were trying to kind of get you there. But specifically when he arrives at the climactic action sequence, that music is so jaunty. It's so like, it's just, it's really disconnected from what I wanted to feel right there. And what could have been like really intense, because it's really, I mean, it's such a cool looking, the production design in this film is, I think, is amazing. His apartment, his house, like, oh my God. And the costumes, like, just, it just had so much going for it visually and aesthetically. There's a lot to love about this film for me personally. I do like post-apocalyptic stuff a lot, and did since I was a, you know, teenager in the 80s. So
I think the horns is what draws me into that score early on. I'm quite sympathetic to old style scoring of movies. I quite like it. I'm scouring record fairs and things to try and find old scores. And I was really forgiving of it. And the person I was with watching this film, my wife, she was not having it at all. She said it really made her feel like she was watching something from the 70s. It instantly dated it.
Yeah.
So, I get what you're saying. I forgive that. But again, yeah, that ending, it's crazy the way it goes.
It is weird. From a score perspective, I mean, I think from in every other regard, I mean, some of the storytelling mechanisms are also kind of old fashioned, right? Like we've really hardened our sensibilities about these kind of heavy things have really hardened as the years have gone on. And it just feels a little unserious at times, you know, but again, that's contrasting it against films from, you know, 50 years later, which isn't really fair. Even 20 years later, it's an unfair comparison because the zeitgeist sort of changes, it evolves.
Oh, totally.
Right.
There is also that thing where Charlton Heston at this period is huge. He's just come off Planet of the Apes. So like that's in the bank. And it reminds me of later on in life when, say, Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he came off his early films and then went into like the higher production of like The Running Man and things like that. So he was that big at that point. And it's really interesting to see like a superstar take on this role. And I guess the reason why he was so up for it is maybe he loved the book, but also because it is just a first half, at least, is just like a personal one man performance.
Sure. I mean, he gets to chew up the scenery a lot. What actor wouldn't jump at this, but he was going, this was like his sci-fi phase, right? Cause then Soylent Green was around that time as well, which is weird. This is also from reading about him. This was also the kind of turning point in his political views. Like the early 70s was when he kind of went from this very kind of civil rights, you know, thinking person to the, like, really the later Charlton Heston. It was right around this period, which is odd, you know, is a weird coincidence, I think.
There is a lot of gun
complicated guy.
Yeah. That's one thing I noticed with Charlton Heston is guns are everywhere in this film.
Man, he's so true. It's like veneers. It's just this, he's so smiley. It's great.
He looks at points giddy when he's well, handling his weapons.
Look at all the guns he got to play with. He was in heaven in that regard.
I really love him around the empty city. And it's a really early, I don't know, I'm trying to watch every single film during our lockdown here that I've missed in my sort of going through horror films. Well, yeah, I just can't find many examples of a man walking around an empty city, empty towns. Mm. There's a few, but this seemed to really, like, put it in the public consciousness. And you see it now all the time. And I remember watching 28 Days Later, and it didn't affect me the way it affected a lot of other people because I'd seen this one first. Do you think that the influence, not just of that, but of everything else in this film, you can see examples of it later on?
You know, two films come to mind that are contemporary films that I thought of a lot while I was watching this. And one was Night Eats the World, that French zombie film.
Yes.
Where the guy is trapped alone in the apartment building. Have you seen that film?
I have seen that. Yeah, it's recent watch as well.
It's wonderful. It's so good. Like, and the scenes of him drumming and just the, like, him just, you know, finding things to occupy his time, and it's really good. And because it sort of takes this concept much further into the film, you know. The other one is the Korean film Hashtag Alive.
Just seen that this week.
Yeah, which is also, I love him figuring out, you know, just how to deal with the situation he finds himself in. Both of these, that just the loneliness of them, that the isolation that those movies deal with, you know, in this post-apocalyptic context, they're even lonelier because their adversaries don't speak, you know, their language are not sentient. You know, the adversaries in the Omega Man have intellect, which is crazy. I know it's a departure from the book, I suspect.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But also of its time, or Manson Family kind of vibe going on there.
Well, they are called the family, aren't they?
That's right, which I think was, yeah, it's very, very, very much referencing the current boogeymen of the time.
Well, there is a really bleak ending to this. Mm-hmm. And if you ignore some of that score, so you're basically just focusing on what you're watching. I was satisfied with it, but only just. I really wanted him not to die, and more than most any film I've seen of recent years, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at that point, I was kind of ambivalent, to be honest, because it was, you know, it just didn't feel very believable. I mean, that the film sort of unravels right there. It's just so staged, and so, like, it doesn't feel real at that point. You know, it was so, like, for him to get wounded and then to be found the next day still clinging to life, he should have died, you know, much sooner than that, you know. And then he, I don't know, it didn't work for me at all. I like a tragic ending. I love, you know, and the Christ, like, you know, like,
oh yeah,
playing out of him, you know. I mean, I think, again, I think there were some great ideas there that I just think didn't really stick the landing.
I'm not disappointed, but I'm really close to disappointed with it. That's the thing.
I love the early part of the film, and I really love Lisa, and I love the relationship with Lisa. I love all of the, I mean, it's weird because of the age difference. It's incredibly weird, but I mean, you know, thinking on it while we were watching it, my wife and I, we were like, well, I mean, if there was nobody left, you know, and you were young and you were beautiful and, you know, you were just like, I'm not going to let this go to waste, you know?
Sure. It never feels like a lot of films from 71. It never gets rapey. It doesn't ever bring that into question. And that I was really relieved by, because I've been watching a lot.
She's a great character. And the way that she's presented in the film, I think, is really great, because she's very much, you know, she's very like, she's very confident and she's very sure of everything in her reality. She's as much as a person can be in control of their own circumstances.
I feel she would totally kick his ass at any moment.
Yeah. Well, also that, I mean, yes, she's great. She's pretty great. My wife remarked, this is one of my favorite observations of it, was their outfits. Every like couple hours, they would be in this new, just kick ass outfit. And my wife was like, I love that they're like dressed up all the time instead of just in sweatpants like all of us.
Well, why not? Why not? It's not like you're going to go out there and you're going to get
go shopping like that. Yeah. Yeah. His like the velvet suit that he's wearing the first when he's like dresses for dinner at the beginning is just, oh man, it's so good. I really could, I would love to hang out in that apartment before it got torn to pieces, but I just, that is just so good. It's just one of the things that I loved the most about the movie was that set of his home. It's just awesome.
I just want to talk to you a little bit about you yourself, what you've got going on. So I reached out to you because I'd watched The Pal Door. Now, I thought the film was great, really enjoyed it, but I kept being taken out of the film at certain places, just thinking, right, when did that moment of that score happen? Making little notes and things like that. And I did it with a film called It Follows as well. I loved the score to that.
I love the score for It Follows as well.
Well, there's a few others, but every now and again, a film will grab you like that. So everything sort of works. You've got the imagery, the music, and it's all combined. So I thank you for that. But
thank
I need
you.
To know a few things about this Pal Door film. So how did you hook up with the, I take it, director Coons?
Aaron and I worked together on stuff. We met kind of through, he was based out of Austin when we met. And we would, we met online through Twitter, and then we started hanging out at Fantastic Fest, the genre film festival in Austin. And I did some spec work for him early on some just some fun bumpers and stuff like that. So he just needed something. I was like, oh, let's do this. And we clicked pretty early on. We worked together well. And so when Scare Package came around, that was the first chance. I'd scored a short film for him previous to that and worked on a trailer for his first film. But Scare Package, he brought me on to score all of the segments for all of the directors.
Wow.
So I worked with entirely different teams on every one of the things, but he thought it would be good to have one composer to kind of meld it all together a little bit more, because you know, each sequence in Scare Package is very different from the stylistically.
But that
and
video
so this was a way to sort of
brings it together.
Yeah, to give it some cohesion, you know, that you wouldn't have to, you know, be too nitpicky about every little detail in the film. So this was a good way to kind of do that. And that was a great experience. And then his section of that, the opening, and then the cold open was by Emily, but the wraparound. The wraparound and then the big ending at Scare Package, that was all Aaron. And so that was our first kind of lengthier collaboration on score. And it went great, because everything leading up to it had gone smoothly. So it just, you know, continued. And then as we were working on Scare Package, he was doing all of the pre-production on Pale Door. And so we were getting, I mean, Pale Door was tantalizing to me because it was horror and Western and just all the occult and witchy stuff. Like, I just could not wait to get my hands on that. And to really focus on just one style for the whole film was appealing as well. Because in Scare Package, I was having to jump around a lot. So it was very appealing. I mean, if you'd asked me what kind of film, it probably would have been, you know, weird Western or like horror sci-fi would have been the two that I would have ordered, you know.
I'm so glad that you did. I'm going to go back now to Scare Package with new eyes on and ears in. I can't wait to listen to that again.
Oh, nice.
Right. Favorite scene is when the gang are going to this brothel. And that's when I noticed this score. It really got me. It's like, oh, okay, here we go. Everything right. seemed to work at that point, and I was totally in. It's really interesting to me, but I'm a musician myself, but I'm a vocalist. So what do I know? Nothing is the answer to that.
you know melody.
Well, yeah, but I know when something works. I just don't know how it's done. And right. How do you approach a scene like that? Where do you get this from in your mind? How do you approach it?
We've given a lot of thought to at what point the turn, like where the turn was going to happen, where it went from. I think there's a couple cues before the turn that have menace, the train robbery, you know, there's menace and suspense and tension in some earlier scenes. But this was the turn where we're like, we're going into supernatural. We're making the transition to the supernatural. So it's very deliberate that this was where everything was going to sort of, you know, tumble yeah. into the real weirdness, because all of the instrumentation sort of before this was very traditional, right? It was using very acoustic and traditional instruments. And after this, we bring in more sound designing. I use a lot of, I sampled a lot of stuff like antlers clacking together and banging on a violin with a chopstick just to get this weird dissonant kind of percussive sound. So I sampled a lot of percussive stuff. And then I have a ton of sample libraries of like just weird instruments. We had a flute that was built from a human femur bone. Now I don't have the bone, but somebody that had access to it created a sample library of it, you know, recorded every pitch and then mapped it. And then I bought the software and was able to play with this thing. So a lot of just weird instruments like that, in addition to stuff that I was able to sample myself. And that was kind of the point. There's one earlier, just when they discover the woman in the chest.
Yeah.
There's a moment when she looks off into the distance and she sees the female Pinkerton sneaking up on them. And she has this look on her facial expression changes to react to that. And we sort of if you rewatch the movie, there's a very quiet, very subtle glissando of antlers clacking just as she reacts to that, that they mixed way back, because it's just the first like supernatural kind of hint that, you know, it shows kind of her dark side is just sort of revealed very subtly in this moment. So once the turn into the town happens, then we really start bringing in a lot more of the like weird, witchy kind of percussive stuff, and then unnatural stuff because it was supernatural. So we could bring in, I didn't want a synth score for that. Aaron didn't want us to do any kind of synth score, but the synthesizers are just they're very off to the side to, you know, for it to feel unnatural.
I hate that word, unreal. Organic, but you're right. It does feel a lot more earthed, this score, than a lot of the current scores that I'm listening to. I love the fact that things are off in the background. I might listen to it next time I watch it with some decent headphones on. Yeah, that's exciting me. final question. What have you got coming up?
I'm working on a film score right now. I don't think I can divulge what it is, because not that it's any big secret, but I don't think they've had the opportunity to announce it yet. They're kind of doing preliminary festival previews and stuff to see about that, but we haven't really announced. So I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to give it away.
Same team?
No, this is a new team. Aaron Kuntz is involved as a producer, so he brought me onto the project, but it's a different director. Other than Aaron's involvement, it's all new people that I haven't worked with before, but they're great. It's been a wonderful experience. This one's set in the late 80s. So it's very synth heavy. It's very of its time. And it's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Alex, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There you go. That was such a cool time. Thank you so much, Alex, for that. I love talking to people within the industry, and he ticks both boxes. He's got that film background and he's got the music background. And that is a good time to me. So if you want to hear Alex's work isolated from the movies, then I would recommend that you can hit him up on Spotify and you can listen to him completely removed of context. But if you do want that context, if it is important to you, then what I would recommend is get yourself a Shudder account if you haven't already and type in Scare Package and also The Pale Door. His work is on both of them. And as I say, with Pale Door, it was one of those films that even though the film itself was good, the soundtrack was just simply incredible. Anyways, back to Omega Man. Where can you watch it? Well, in the USA, you can stream it for free on HBO Max or everywhere else in the world, you can just rent it. Alternatively, if you've seen it enough times and you want to listen to a podcast about the thing, well, you could do a lot worse than checking out this massive, massive podcast. A team called The Projection Booth did this one way back in July 19. It's 3.5 hours. It's a beauty. All the ins, all the outs, all the Charlton Hestons. You're going to love it. Okay, there you go. The Omega Man.
Excellent. Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
Ever you.